Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk. All right, we have a special edition today. So during the past couple months, governments around the world and in the United States have been basing their responses to the COVID-19 pandemic in part on models that project the toll of the virus. These models forecast levels of hospitalization and death, and when exactly the strains on the healthcare system could be the most pronounced. One of the models that the Trump administration and state governments have referenced frequently is from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. And so here with us today to talk about that model is its creator, doctor and health economist Chris Murray. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
So Nate and I have a lot of questions for you, but let's just start off with some basics. What is the general approach you took to modeling the toll of the COVID-19 pandemic? Essentially, what are the key elements that go into your model?
So basically, we have two parts to the model. One part is a model to try to project out what the course of the epidemic is going to be. And for that, we, in general, for our work, want to be really grounded in the data that's flowing in. And so we used essentially a nonlinear mixed effects modeling framework to try to fit a error function curve to the shape of the epidemic that fit rather well for Wuhan City. And so when we started out, that was the only sort of quote completed first wave epidemic. So we adopted that functional form, and then we have a model that essentially has three parameters, and we try to fit those three parameters to the data in each place. And there's a covariate on social distancing that predicts one of the parameters, the beta parameter, that tells you when the peak is going to occur. So that's the, you know, there's a lot of bells and whistles we can talk about that we've kept adding as we go to try to address issues that people have raised. And then the second part of the model is to go from a prediction of death into the estimate of the need for hospitalization, ICU use, and ventilation, sort of going backwards, because there's actually a lot of data that can tell us what's the ratio of hospitalizations, admissions, and ventilator use per death. And so that's a micro-simulation framework for the second part of the model. So that's basically the two parts.
Nate's been tracking kind of a lot of this data as almost a second job during this pandemic. So Nate, I want to let you get in here and ask Chris some questions.
So thank you, Chris. So are you trying to estimate the infection rate or attack rate, I guess you'd call it? Are there any assumptions about how many people actually have or had COVID?
You know, when we started out, we largely were ignoring the case report data because of incredible variability in access to testing. So like in here in Washington, there was an incredible shortage of tests. So we knew that what tests were available were being preferentially used for the sickest patients. So that's sort of how we ended up thinking that the death data was going to be more reliable over time than the case data. So we built the whole framework around trying to not use the case notification data. However, as we're now facing states taking off social distancing, we're now in a situation where we sort of need to back into what are likely infections in the community. So we've actually now added that in. So we go from modeling deaths back into infections using the sort of data where there's age-specific information, case fatality rates in settings where there's a lot of testing, so we think it's getting close to the infection fatality rate, and then using the data on the average period from infection to death, which is about 16 to 20 days. So now we've added that part, and that's factoring into some of the new types of analyses that we're starting to roll out.
I'm curious, one of the criticisms that we've heard of your model from epidemiologists is that it relies in large part, almost entirely, off of data from cities and countries that have previously experienced the virus. And then it charts the curve for the U.S. based on that data. And so then, of course, the question becomes, well, is the other country's data, like China, is it reliable? Is it accurate? And do different countries and different demographics and cultures have different ways that the virus spreads because of how densely the cities are packed or just how they interact in general or how old the community may be? And then, of course, mitigation measures look different in China. They look different in Italy. They look different here in the U.S. So how do you try to address the fact that the data itself may have some holes in it and that the virus's spread is going to look different across all of these different places?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first off, we're pretty happy with the way we deal with age, which is what we do is we take all the data that we're fitting our model to and use indirect age standardization. And so, for example, when we run a model for Alabama, we convert all the data for all the locations that are going to go into the statistical fitting procedure to the age structure of Alabama. So then we're fitting a model that is reflecting the age structure of Alabama and not the age structure of where we got the data. And, you know, if you're a much younger population, like the District of Columbia is younger, then, you know, that gets reflected in the likely death rates and the course. So age, we're sort of happy with. Much harder question is this question around, you know, the transmissibility, the social behavior, the contact rates. Again, you know, largely, if you don't fit to actual data, then you're in the land of making up assumptions and sticking them into a transmission model. And of course, you can get any result you want by playing with the parameters in an infectious disease transmission dynamics model. We make lots of them. We've made thousands of those models since the epidemic started. We're not enormously confident that these reflect real fits to real data. But the big limitation is, as you said, we are counting on the relationships we see between social distancing, as now measured in mobility data, because we're trying to incorporate that, and time to peak in Italy, in Spain, and in Wuhan. We have done sensitivity testing where we drop Wuhan. It makes zero difference to our results at this point, right? Because there's enough of these epidemic peaks in Italy and Spain that doesn't change the results. So, yeah, it's a huge issue, but we don't really see a data-driven approach that provides us right now an alternative.
I mean, it kind of seems like all the evidence on COVID assumes some parameters, uses hard data on some parameters, and then those are used to estimate some third set of parameters. But philosophically, you're kind of saying we want to make fewer assumptions that would introduce epidemiological parameters and more infer it from the death data, right?
Well, philosophically, we're trying to find something that's going to be really grounded in data that comes in on some regular basis. And the reason for that is, you know, if you go back in time, I happen to have been an executive director at the World Health Organization in charge of evidence, information, and policy when SARS-1 was there. And all the modelers told us at that time there was going to be an enormous epidemic and there was going to be this large second wave, and neither occurred. Now, maybe that was because we did a phenomenal job on, you know, travel bans and mitigation, or it was that the original models were wrong. But if you go back and trace like the papers published on Ebola or the papers published on many infectious disease epidemics, the nature of SEIR models is they do tend to always show this huge increase up to the point of saturation where most people get infected. And very often that has not historically happened. So we wanted to find a strategy that is not simply saying everybody's eventually going to get infected and you're going to have this enormous burden on the health system, because historically that has tended to be on the high side. And so that's sort of where we've tried to find a way to anchor it in data, albeit, you know, you're stuck having to make some assumptions to make this work.
One critique that people have had that I've found somewhat interesting, persuasive, I guess, is the notion of how symmetrical the curves might be. That if you have a place where, say, R is 0.9 or 0.95, you might have a very long kind of flat top. Does the model make assumptions about R, or how would it deal with a case like that?
So, you know, there's an implicit assumption about R, but you know, we're not modeling R, but we are now in a branch of the modeling framework. But I think that's a pretty important concern, because now that we've seen more data, we didn't see it in Wuhan, but when you look in half the places in Italy and Spain, you look at New York, you look at London, you get these very long, flat peaks and then slow declines. And so to address that in the latest version that we released last Friday, we have added this, multiple mixture model component. So we fit the basic model that we had before, and then we fit a linear combination of those staggered in space. And so that combination now accommodates for the flat peaks. And then we take the evidence that we get on the weighting scheme of that mixture model from the places that have peaked and use that to inform the places that have not. Long story short, we no longer have the symmetry requirement that was there before. And so I think that's an improvement in the modeling framework. It does mean that our tail is longer. The other thing that we are doing, because I think as states like Texas take off their social distancing, the framework we've been using is not going to be great to get the nuance of if I remove one version, one type of social mandate versus another, and we can drive the future projections by both testing and mobility data. So what we've now done is we've taken the SEIR models that we're always a little bit reluctant to use and fit them to the observed data that we've got on death and our first 12 to 14 days of our forecast, which we sort of think do rather well in our out-of-sample predictive validity testing. And then we now have an R-type model that varies over time that's consistent with our statistical model. And in that framework, we can work on figuring out how different changes in transmission may occur. One of the byproducts of doing that is that some of those fits, the sort of variable R models, suggest that the tails may be longer even than our new sort of multi-Gaussian strategy.
So what's the scope exactly? Is it, because initially it seemed like here's what we get in the first wave with social distancing in place. But then if you wind up with kind of half-assed social distancing in some places, strict in others, when do you stop and say, okay, we violated the scope and therefore we might make a new model, but we can no longer, evaluate how well our prediction did because it made these assumptions that have been violated in Georgia or whatnot?
Yeah. Go back to what we started off. We started off trying to meet a request from our own hospital system and then a bunch of other hospital systems about helping them predict peak use. And so, and then we have also, because, in our day jobs, because this is not our day job, we generally do measures and modeling and sort of tracking of health outcomes around the world. So our goal has been to help planners in, every country of the world. So we're always trying to think about how we're going to take our framework and use it elsewhere. The framework we've got works pretty well, in at least in the 2 to 3 weeks out, in places with decent cause of death data. And so we think we can and are will be releasing for Latin, a bunch of countries in Latin America. We've done Europe. We'll move into other places that have cause of death data. But as you've said, our big challenge is what happens when people do weird mixtures of, taking off, relaxing social distancing when they shouldn't, when there's still plenty of transmission. So we will inevitably add to our model ensemble some of these, fitted transmission models that may allow us to answer some of those questions more effectively. So we're thinking that our model pool, which already has basically three models in it, we will add in these fitted transmission models, and then over time we'll see if we have to sort of retire the death models once people no longer have any social distancing in place.
Yeah, Chris, one thing that I think has made, a lot of what we're talking about here is pretty wonky stuff, but one thing that has definitely permeated into the mainstream is the shift in the original projection of deaths and hospitalization when the White House first kind of presented your model to the nation and now. So originally the White House was talking about 100 to 200,000 Americans dying from COVID-19 based on the IHME model. It's been revised down to around 60,000 through the beginning of August as we talk right now. So our listeners know that to some extent, models are based on probability. And we don't talk about whether or not the model was right or wrong. It's more, is it useful? And is it good probabilistically? So we understand that. But what did happen? Why did we end up seeing those hospitalization and death rates fall significantly from when we were first presented the model?
So the 100 to 240,000 number that the White House spoke about was from some other model that nobody's actually ever seen because they've never released it. Our original forecasts, if you go back to our first release, was a range of 35,000 to 150,000 with the, you know, the mean of the distribution being 81,000 by memory. And then we bumped up and down. We went up to about 90, we came down, and then eventually we ended up right now at the current numbers at 60,000. They're probably going to go up because of all the nursing home deaths that we're missing. And as we start to get more of that incorporated, so I think they'll go up again as that data flows in. But, you know, the interesting thing is that despite changes in models and changes in data, every set of our numbers so far have been well within the range of our original forecast. And in fact, our range right now looks awfully similar to what we were a month ago. That, you know, that's not proof of anything. It's just proof of that, you know, you apply the same approach, even though the data is changing, you're going to get something that's not so wildly different.
I'm curious. Do you feel that the White House misrepresented your work early on?
No, I think they, well, I you know, I'm not a big news consumer, so I can't remember.
I think, Galen, people are conflating this 100 to 200K number, which is from a mysterious source. I don't know if it was Jared Kushner's buddies or whatever, with their model, which has never shown numbers that high.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know where their model number came from. You know, when the president and the task force put up pictures of our model somewhat unexpectedly, that was ours. It was straight off our website. So, and then they had that other graph of the 240 and the 100. You know, I don't know if you remember that graph, but there was no time on the x-axis, which was the other interesting thing about the model they put up. You know, there was no actual scale of when those different peaks were. So having said that, there is some confusion out there because people do seem to assign to us those bigger numbers. The one thing that we did change very substantially, and, you know, it was again a reflection of the data, we did downgrade quite substantially our estimate of ventilator need. And the reason for that was that when we first made our estimates, we were using a pretty small data set that CDC put out on practice patterns, namely the ratio of ICU and ventilator use per death. And then as new data flooded in from New York and other states, it turned out that that original data set from CDC was very much on the high end. And so that led to a big change down in our, like in the second iteration of our models.
Isn't that also true for the overall hospital beds number and the ICU number?
Yeah, because the original CDC numbers were literally 11 hospitalizations per death. And now in a state like New York, we're around about 4. It's like 4.5, 4.6. And we've now looked state by state, and that number is surprisingly variable. And our theory goes that in states where there's not a lot of pressure yet on resources, they're much more, you know, admitting many more people. When there starts to be pressure on the resources, they're sending a lot more people home. And they're learning through practice and experience, you know, who's it's safe to send home versus not.
I mean, it does seem like that's one initial assumption, not just in your model, but in a lot of the stuff I read, where you read stuff from a month ago, and it might assume that 14% of infections result in hospitalizations, or usually not quite that high. I think Imperial College was 4.5, but you see other numbers as high as 20. And it looks to me like it's more like 2% or something, although you have to make a lot of inferences about how many missed cases, or missed infections, I should say, there are. Is that a pleasant surprise, or what do you think about that overall?
Yeah, the 2% number is probably way too low. And it gets back to, you know, this other controversy in the background that eventually antibody data is going to answer for us. But of course, the first round of antibody data is confusing everybody because there's rampant false positives and bad tests, et cetera. But back to the question, which is the fraction of people who have severe infection. If you go from death backwards, because, you know, anchoring on something that we know more than trying to guess infections in the community, you know, the lower number, I don't know if it's good news or bad news, because I think practice patterns are adapting to the shortages in different settings. So in some parts of Spain, the ratio of hospitalizations to death went down as low as like 2. So I don't think that's a great marker. You know, basically, if you get hospitalized, you have a 50% chance of dying because they're just sending so many people home at the point of the peak. So the other way of thinking about it, like what fraction of true infections really depends on the infection fatality rate. And we have our own view about that. But I think that will only be resolved once antibody testing of high quality comes out.
And what is that? What is that view? Do you have
our view is so we do a random effects meta regression of all the age specific data on cases and deaths that we can find. And then we take the, you know, we get the age pattern from that. And then we take the lowest value of the random effect to figure out what's the closest number to the infection fatality rate as opposed to the case fatality rate. The place that has that smallest random effect is actually the Diamond Princess, not a place, but the ship. And so that's the one that we use right now as our best estimate of the infection fatality rate. That number is about 5% at age 85. And if you're below age 30, it's like 0.02%. So, you know, hugely variable by age.
Chris, over the years, we at 538 have gotten to experience firsthand what it's like to put out a model into the world and see how the public reacts to probabilistic forecasts, and, you know, sometimes we ourselves get backlash and so on. And, you know, sometimes the media doesn't do a great job of covering it. Sometimes we don't do a great job of explaining probability maybe to the public. I'm curious, how do you think the media has covered your work? Where have they gotten things right? Where have they gotten things wrong? And what really should the public be focused on in your view when it comes to this kind of data?
Well, I do have to confess that on my iPhone, your site is one of my top 10 sites. I tend to go to it every day, so I'm a pretty big fan. But on terms of the media coverage of our work, you know, I've been sort of surprised by how, because there's so much attention on the pandemic, that there are a lot of pretty sophisticated journalists these days that seem to ask pretty sharp questions that I think if you weren't in the throes of a pandemic and they were super read up about all sorts of details, they wouldn't be asking. So that's been one positive thing. You know, the downside on the media coverage is people overinterpret, you know, getting very concerned about changes in models. So that's been one of the challenges. I think you guys struggle with this. How do you explain that, you know, going from 60 to 80 when your range is 35 to 150 is not really a big change. But of course, that's not how people perceive it. So that's an interesting challenge. I think it's extremely difficult, as always, to get any notion of uncertainty across to you know, the non geeky audience.
Yeah, I often find there are things that I think are weaknesses in our model, and then there are things the press thinks are weaknesses, and those things aren't related very much.
Yeah, no, I think you know, I've gotten a lot of interviews where people say, well, you know, why has your model gone from 68 to 60? That's a huge change. And to me, you know, that's just not a huge change. So, but it is part and parcel of the challenge.
Before we wrap up here, I know you have maybe a more important engagement to get to, so we're short on time. Your model is mostly focused on the flattening of the first curve and giving death and hospitalization projections according to that. What are you starting to think about beyond that first curve in terms of whether or not there will be a second curve, whether it could be more deadly, whether or not we'll ever get this curve tamped down to the point where there are very few deaths by the end of the summer?
Well, have a look what's happening in New Zealand. They look like they're really stopping transmission. I mean, they may be the superstars in terms of both, you know, just bringing mobility down to like an incredibly low level and then cases coming down to near zero. So if anybody's going to do it, looks like New Zealand's actually going to stop transmission, at least until it gets reintroduced. You know, I think we're trying to look ahead to when and where and if there'll be further waves. You know, likely there will be, given so many people are going to be susceptible, but we can't forget that SARS-1 never came back. So we'll try to model that out. I think the biggest thing that we're worried about is modeling the potential, you know, evolution of the epidemic in low and middle income countries. And the reason we haven't put numbers out yet is this question about temperature and seasonality, where even a casual inspection of the data suggests that there is a temperature effect. But is that just a false signal because the data is so much lower quality in the tropics, or is it real? And so we're spending a lot of time right now trying to test hypotheses about, you know, can we explain differences between like why this huge epidemic in New York and we don't have huge epidemics in other large cities? Is it population density? Is it comorbidity prevalence? Is it air pollution? Is it temperature? What is it? You know, we're looking for those predictors, because if we don't have those predictors, how do we make a prediction for Ghana or for Ethiopia or DRC without something more in the model? Otherwise, we're going to be in the absurdity where our uncertainty will be from super small to insanely large saturation, you know, huge, huge numbers of deaths. So that's probably the thing that's giving us the most concern right now, which is how do we do what is our day job, in a sense, which is helping low and middle income countries make better choices about, you know, health policy.
And what do you do in general about, as countries and states and cities revise how they count deaths? I mean, New York City has a confirmed and a probable category now, right? How will you interpret it if you were kind of measuring confirmed deaths, or I don't know if that's what you were, and then people add probable deaths and they say, oh, you guys were way too low. Yeah, I mean, this is why I prefer elections, because elections, you can debate why someone wins, but there's one result at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's causing our data teams, because, you know, we've got a big group of modelers and, you know, people looking at the data working on this. And they are spending a lot of time trying to reconstruct what's going on, and then we rerun the model. So for New York, we're taking the probables, we're trying to figure out when they occurred back in time, because they're getting reported in this big bolus, and that's throwing all the models, making them go crazy in the middle of the night. So then we have to go back and reconstruct. And then other states are doing the same thing, but not necessarily telling us that they're reporting this big set of deaths. We're finding out in some states that, you know, there's just this Monday, Sunday problem where reported deaths just drop off because of the weekend, and then they catch up on Tuesday. All sorts of, you know, super difficult data problems when you're fitting a nonlinear model to a time series. So, you know, we're trying to also build in some resilience in the modeling so that they're not super sensitive to the vagaries of the data. Then this New York Times today, the big discussion of not just probable and confirmed, but what about excess mortality? And the problem on the excess mortality is some of that is people deferring care because they're not going in. We know from cardiology groups around the country that the number of people showing up with heart attacks is way down. But it's unlikely they're not having heart attacks. And so how much of the excess mortality is COVID and how much of it is our response to COVID? And, you know, we shouldn't assign the excess heart attacks to, you know, the epidemic curve modeling for COVID. We'll get it wildly wrong. So there's a ton of data challenges for us to try. And we're just trying to keep up with them as we learn about them and investigate. And at the same time, try to scale up to other countries which have even more data problems.
All right. Well, we've heard that you have a call to get on with the White House, so we will let you get to that. Maybe sometime in the future, we can have you back and talk about what more we learn about this pandemic and the data associated with it in the future. But for now, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
No, pleasure. And like I said, I'm a huge fan, so I'd love to come back on. It's a great pleasure to meet you both.
We definitely will. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Dr. Chris Murray is the director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, at the University of Washington and creator of the IHME COVID-19 model. All right, Nate, so we got to talk to the man at the center of all of this COVID-19 modeling. I mean, what did you make of how he is formulating the spread of this disease in his head and trying to express it, you know, in a model?
I mean, look, I think modeling is hard, and you see a couple of points of view expressed throughout the interview that I think is consistent with what we knew before. Number one, it is very much taking deaths as the most solid piece of evidence that we have and trying to use that data to make inferences without imposing a lot of priors. Very much the whole art and science of modeling is where you want to wind up on spectrum of having a rigid model where you have very strong priors to having kind of no priors at all and pure quote-unquote curve fitting. And I don't know enough about this field to know what the right answer is, right? But clearly he's on the side where we're going to fit curves and we're not going to apply so many priors for better or worse, right? But that's one of the questions you'd ask about philosophically where someone stand. Another question is, how much do you go and tweak things and tinker with things as you go along? And he's on the side that says, you know what, we're learning more about this as it goes along, and we're going to revise things, not just the data, but revise assumptions and functional forms of the model. And we're not going to apologize for that much because we're following the evidence as it evolves, right? At 538, we try to do less of that with our election models, unless kind of we find bugs. We try not to, or there are situations we didn't anticipate. I guess it's more ambiguous. We try not to do so much of that, but I don't know. If I were building a COVID model, then I might feel differently because we do know a lot more about this in mid-April than we did in mid-March, and we'll know a lot more, we hope, in mid-May than in mid-April.
Right. I mean, I think this is something that I talked about a little bit with our quant editor, Laura, and science writer, Maggie, in the past, but, you know, this is a new virus. So there are so few things that we know about it, such little historical data, that you can't look at all of the times this virus has popped up since 1975 and try to understand its transmissibility or so on, right? Like, you kind of are just learning a whole bunch of things about it as it spreads across the globe, which is very different to, you know, forecasting an election or the result of a baseball or basketball championship, right?
Yeah, look, and I think, ironically, in election data or polling data, people are very concerned if a poll shows a candidate at 48% and then they get 51%, and so they narrowly win instead of narrowly losing. That's a pretty small magnitude problem compared to what you face here, where everything is suspect, right? That there could be 50% more deaths than are recorded officially, for example. With cases, it's even worse, right? There could be anywhere from, I don't know, 6 or 7 times more infections and reported cases to 50 times more infections, right? And that creates big problems. I think it's part of why he's kind of saying, hey, look, I don't even want to try it, estimate too many parameters, because nothing is rock solid here, and deaths is the most solid thing we have. Although, as we learn more about how deaths are counted or not counted, then especially if you get into parts of the world apart from the U.S. and Western Europe, then there's a lot of ambiguity there as well. But it's a very hard problem. And to some extent, I am empathetic because even if he is making choices that someone else might not, like I'm usually more sympathetic to, hey, let's actually have a bit more structure and more stronger priors. That's where I probably line up on that debate philosophically. There are not very many other models out there that are public, that are updating in real time, that are subject to a lot of scrutiny. And I kind of think you should have roughly 20 times more authority on this question if you've built a model yourself. And most people have not. And so it's a little bit like, okay, well, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And with your assumptions, what would things look like? And would the model have been any more accurate? And how would it react to funky things in the data? Like all of a sudden, New York City says, okay, well, here are a bunch of deaths we should have counted originally and we didn't. So we're going to report all of them on the same day. You know, how do you deal with things like that? And there are a lot of challenges just wrangling the data from day to day and trying to not have the model go haywire.
Nate, I guess this comes to maybe a more fundamental question about modeling. I think it was last week or the week before on Twitter, Senator John Cornyn from Texas was like, you know, we need to have a discussion about how we're using these models to predict the future and like whether or not it's even worthwhile or something like that. And so we obviously believe that creating models to try to forecast the future, there's value in it. When it comes to a pandemic, where there is so little that you do know about it from the start, maybe this is just a really basic question. What kind of value does this add when there are so many uncertainties?
Well, look, clearly at least getting magnitudes of order right is probably important. That, you know, if magnitude of order 50 to 150,000 people die as a result of social distancing, or not as a result of it, but as a result of preventing deaths from doing it, that's pretty different than if 500,000 to 1.5 million people die, right? Certainly kind of, I think he emphasized, hey, look, the most value that we can provide is by predicting the peak of when things occur. And if the magnitudes are a little off or even a lot off, you still can have some sense of when things are getting worse and when things are getting better and when they might peak. And that provides some value. And I think on the peak, they've actually been pretty decent. That you might misstate the shape of this, in particular this asymmetry thing where the one side on a downslope, it's a slower downslope and a quicker upslope. But their peak forecasts seem to have been reasonably good. And that provides some value there. But yeah, look, I mean, we're making all these complex trade-offs, and we're making these trade-offs, and then it might turn out that the infection fatality rate, so of people who get not diagnosed, but people who catch the bug, how many people die, that number could be 0.2 or it could be 1.2. And that's a six-fold difference. And we're trying to balance all these considerations. Well, it would seem like a six-fold difference probably would matter in which choices we might make. And so you do have to be specific within some range of uncertainty. You can't just kind of say, oh, here's a conceptual framework and it's close enough, right? Because we're trying to squeeze out every kind of part of rationality society has and how to make these very difficult trade-offs. And so you can't tell me that, you know, a twofold or threefold or a sixfold difference in death rates or hospitalization rates, I mean, that has to make some difference, and it ought to make some difference in the long run. Whether that comes from modeling the future or from kind of carefully looking at data that we have in hand already is, I think, an important question. If you're projecting a certain number of deaths, then that could come from two things, right? Let's say you're projecting a low number. Let's say you have an optimistic model and says, okay, only 50,000 people are going to die in this particular country when most people think it's more, right? That could be because, number one, you think the fatality rate is lower, so lots of people get it, but it's not as severe. Or it could be because you think that you'll not have that many cases, so it's pretty deadly, but we can suppress how many people actually acquire the disease. You know, it might be helpful to kind of clarify where that comes from, which of those two assumptions governs that, And I think maybe one weakness of their approach is they're not explicitly estimating that many parameters. So you maybe kind of accurately know how many deaths there are, but you don't know why it's that number versus some other number, which can not necessarily matter so much in the short run, but can matter in the long run if you're trying to forecast what will happen when social distancing lets up, what would happen, you know, do we have herd immunity? Those things might seem to be important.
So finally, on maybe a more personal note, you know, you've told me before that you like modeling sports more than politics because people get, you know, there are less assholes screaming when it comes to modeling sports. What do you think about the prospect? I mean, can you imagine the kind of the situation Chris is in where he's forecasting the number of Americans that are going to die on a national scale? I mean, what do you think of that? How do you process that kind of pressure?
I am very sympathetic because I think there are a lot more ways that he'll be criticized than he'll be praised for being right. You know, if it's too high, too low, at least in election forecasting, we mostly get criticized only if it's the wrong quote-unquote call. That if we have someone narrowly ahead and they win in a landslide, people tend not to care that much. He's going to get criticized if the numbers come in either way. You have, I don't know, it's interesting, the epidemiologists I follow, where I think they're very smart and very intelligent, but a lot of them don't seem to want to put their necks out there as much. And I admire someone who does, because the risk-reward ratio is not that forgiving in the real world.
All right, well, let's leave things there. Nate, thank you for joining me for this special edition of Model Talk.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also find 538 on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.